Where have all the Catholic men gone? You hear this from Catholic women. Sometimes Catholic men say, where have all the Catholic women gone? And I'm here today with Kennedy Hall. He just finished and published a book, Terror of Demons. And I'll put that on the screen just now. He's going to talk to us today about, this is ultimately not a question primarily about gender, but it's about the devil. Theology.
Yeah.
Kennedy Hall, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm great. No pipe today.
No, it's a little too early this morning.
Agreed. Okay, well, we'll pray our Father.
Okay.
And then we'll jump into this, and we'll talk about St. Joseph. We'll talk about demons. We'll talk about feminism. We'll talk about courtship, holy matrimony, Adam and Eve, all that good stuff.
Cool.
Kennedy, do you want to pray the second half on the Our Father?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. Everybody pray with us, please. Oremus. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Pater noster, qui est in cæli, sanctificetur nomen tuum, advenient regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in cielo et in terra.
Panem nostrum quotidianum da nobis hodie, et dimitti nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris, et ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos a malo. Amen.
Amen. Sancte Joseph, ora
pro nobis.
In nomine Patris et Filii,
et Filii, et Spiritus
Sancti. Amen. Terror of demons.
Yeah.
All right. Break it down for us.
Okay, so I thought that I was looking for books that men needed to become more virtuous. We definitely have a problem in the Catholic Church and in society as a whole, where men don't really know how to be virtuous, you know, and even men that convert to the faith and, you know, they get real good at all, like the spiritual things. You need to have the spiritual side, but you also have to have the side of physical virtue, discipline, leadership, you know, all those things that are integral to being a good husband and a good father. And I looked around, and there's definitely some good books about there's good books about like men and women, sort of from a psychological perspective. There's good books about various like documents that talk about masculinity. But as far as like something you can just give to somebody and say, here you go, this is how you're going to be a terror of demons. So you're going to be like Saint Joseph. Mm-hmm. You're going to be holy, all those kinds of things. I thought there was a need for that. So that's what we're doing with this one.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, some of these books, I've looked at them, I've read some of them. One of my criticisms that I see, especially in books written in the 90s and the 2000s, is they truly stress that husband, wife, male, female, they like to use the word complementary.
Yeah.
Complementary. It's a big deal. And there's a lot of a fear about talking of headship.
Right.
The man is the God-appointed leader. There's a lot of, I can tell right now people are going to start getting ticked off that I just said that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's true that God created Eve to complement Adam, but she's also a helpmate.
Mm-hmm.
She's taken from the side, and we all know that homily, not from the head, not
yes.
from the feet, but from the rib.
Under the heart, whatever.
Yes, to be at his side, which is all true. It's all true.
Yes.
But she's there as a helpmate. And of course, you read a few more verses in there, and you've got the serpent, the devil, original sin. And then you have God's punishments that he places on the man and the woman.
Right.
The man has to work by the sweat of his brow. It's labor intensive.
Yep.
And the woman is in pain in childbirth.
Right.
And her desire shall be for her husband. That's sometimes forgotten by people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it'd be helpful to do a little theology of man, woman, Adam, Eve, God, devil.
Yep.
From the very beginning, because that sets the frame for anything else we can talk about. I know your book covers that. So,
right.
You want to go there?
Right. So, there's a few things we have to understand. Like, our society, like you said, even in the church, is so reluctant to talk about headship. But it's because, in my opinion, we live in a very Marxist society. You know, people think communism is all about money, and that's one of the most effective methods of communism. But communism is ultimately about state worship, social control, etc. It's against the family, against marriage, all those things. It's a very bad thing. And one of the things that Karl Marx uses as a device to get people to go against each other is he separates groups into like power groups. So you have the rich and you have the poor. And it's just automatically bad that the rich are rich, and it's automatically bad that the poor are poor. So you need to have a class struggle, right? You need to make an enemy out of your neighbor, essentially. And even in the church, even in very smart Catholics, because we have been inundated with this Marxist way of looking at the world, where there's winners and losers and nothing else. And if you're part of a winner class, you must be bad and a loser. You know, that whole thing, right. That's a whole other show for itself. But unfortunately, because we do inherently recognize that there are differences between men and women, and we look at things very materialistically in our society, you know, what's your job? How much money do you have? How big is your house? Whatever. Unfortunately, we tend to look at the relationship between men and women as a power relationship. And I think that does a lot of disservice, because the Bible shows us in Genesis, and also St. Paul talks about it more than once, about the headship of the husband in the household. And that's something that makes a lot of people squeamish. And I admit that, you know, a few years ago when I was kind of just a conservative Catholic and I hadn't really thought about this, I would have said, ooh, I hope, you know, Father doesn't talk about that this Sunday because people are going to, you know. But we also need to realize, and I think I'll use what St. Paul says about it to explain how God lays it out in Genesis. When he talks about the headship and the submission, etc., for one, we need to understand, what does the word submission mean? Well, sub means under and mission means mission. So to be under the mission of somebody is to allow them to lead in a way that is best for everyone involved. Okay. So when St. Paul talks about submission, he lays out, for example, you have the mutual submission, which everyone focuses on today, and no one forgets the second part. But that's important, because men and women do mutually submit themselves to one another, because they are each other's instrument of sanctification in order to be saved, in order to achieve salvation. So I am my wife's, and my wife is mine. This is the vows we take at our marriage. I belong to her, she belongs to me. There's your mutual submission, and it's a wonderful thing. But then we have a sort of practical order of operation, let's call it, within the household.
Yeah.
Exactly, the economy. Based on our natures, based on raising children, based on protection, based on all of these things that are fundamental. And the church, the church lays out, using Genesis, using Corinthians, using in Ephesians when St. Paul talks about it, the reason that there is this headship is because it facilitates the sanctification of the family. It puts the father in the place of priest. And also, one thing to remember, Eve is created as Adam's helpmate, which is actually a beautiful term. I mean, if somebody is saying they need your help, it's because they believe that you are basically exceptional and worthy of the role of helping them, which there is an essential equality of dignity there. Furthermore, it means that the responsibility is Adam's.
Yeah.
Okay. So if Eve is created to help Adam, that means, hey, it's on your shoulders as the man, and it's your job to only delegate certain things that you can't do yourself or need help doing, but you need to facilitate a life that is conducive to your wife's happiness and your wife's sanctification as well. So that's sort of my elevator pitch about what the creation of man and woman is about.
Yeah. And that help part, you know, for those of you that study Latin, we have bishops and auxiliary bishops. An auxiliary is a helper bishop.
Right.
He helps. What does that mean? He's not the one in charge.
Right.
He's not the ordinary. He helps the main bishop, the ordinary bishop, but the auxiliary is there to support. So anytime you have the helper come in, that means that there is a leader, there is a head, and that is the man. Now, Kennedy.
Yeah.
1,000 feminists just screeched out.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, but what about my abusive dad, my deadbeat husband, etc.? Yeah. You guys are out here just, you know, talking about submit to all these evil, bad men. You don't know my life. You don't know.
Yeah.
What is the answer to that?
Okay.
Because I can hear the screeches from far away.
I can hear them too. Yes. I can hear them too. Okay. Let's just take and the book is not about feminism, but I've realized writing a book on masculinity, apparently.
Yes.
Writing something that is pro-masculinity, and we'll talk about what masculinity actually means. People assume that you must somehow be anti-woman. It's literally the opposite.
Right.
I wrote this book. I'll get a little bit fired up here. I am so tired of living in a society where you walk down the street and you know that 7 out of 10 men are addicted to pornography. I am so tired of walking down the street knowing that you know that all of these, so many men that you're walking by are, they're reluctant to suffer to do what is best for their families. So let's just take the feminist idea at face value. Let's just say we've got a society that's full of a lot of men who need to get their act together. I 100% agree with that, which is why I wrote a book to help men become virtuous so they can be the men they were called to be by God. If we have a society wherein women are getting treated poorly, which is very true in some cases, then the remedy to that is not extinguishing good masculinity. The remedy to that is not extinguishing men or whatever. The remedy is giving men a way to behave properly. It's a tragedy that the way that so many men treat women. And, I had a daughter a couple years ago. I've got 3 sons. God willing, we'll have more children. I hope we do. But I'm not going to just sit by and expect that my daughter in, 16 years has her going through courtship or whatever with some man she met at school or something. And this guy is just like a sniveling weasel because that's the cultural norm. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And I'm not going to have my sons grow up in a society, at least as far as I can help it, where when we say things like boys will be boys, we mean that they're going to, watch porn and play video games all day. I can't abide that. So this book was written. I can't. This book was written because men need to be called to account. A book that is about men being called to be good men is the most pro-woman book I could think of writing. Yep. There you go.
Yep. Yeah. I think what the feminist who's outraged by things that we're saying, they don't hear the second part, which you just so beautifully articulated. And that is, look, the problem you have with men is they are addicted to alcohol,
exactly,
drugs, pornography. The men that you are talking about are slaves to the flesh.
Exactly.
And woman, in her nature, does rebel against this.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you might even say, it's ontological hypocrisy. The okay. man should be a mirror of God the Father. He should demonstrate the sacrificial love of Christ for the church. He should be the protector and the silent guardian of Mary and Jesus like Joseph.
Exactly.
And so when women see that thwarted so deeply, and the devil wants to thwart it so mm-hmm. deeply,
yeah,
they rightly do get upset. What we're saying, or what you're saying in this book, and I echo it, we don't want men to be slaves to sex, drugs, video games, gambling, Netflix, and especially pornography, masturbation. That's what we're trying to say. Because once you encounter these men,
mm-hmm.
then you are going to say, I want to be your helpmate. I want to be your Eve. I want to be your daughter.
Yeah. Yesterday we were walking through the forest like a trail. And my little girl, man, I love that child. And she was wearing like this little bonnet thing. She's like 2 years old. And she had this pretty little pink dress on. And she was running around with a little magnifying glass, finding snails and things like that. My boys were off literally like shoving each other in the creek and throwing rocks at each other. And like, okay, it was a pretty funny little sociological snapshot of little boys and girls there. But I was thinking about my little girl and I thought, we've all seen these fairy tales growing up, and Disney unfortunately has done a bad job at, take the story of Cinderella, for example. In the true story of Cinderella, the stepsisters are actually quite beautiful. And in the movie Disney, the stepsisters are very ugly to look at. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an easy choice for Prince Charming. He doesn't choose. But in the story, like the stepsisters are actually the temptresses. They're quite beautiful. And he chooses Cinderella based on her merit as a virtuous woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Christian story. And I thought, man, we've got this patrimony, this history, this heritage of Christian folklore and literature that, Chesterton said fairy tales do not exist in order to teach children that dragons are real. Children know dragons are real. They exist to show children how dragons can be defeated. Right. And I was looking at my little girl and I thought, why does Prince Charming have to be a myth? Why does Prince Charming have to be fiction? Why does he only have to exist for an hour and a half when you're watching Frozen or whatever? Prince Charming is the archetype of the chivalrous Christian man who will model Jesus Christ, who will carry the cross, and who will lay down his life for the women and for the children and for the people that he loves the most. And that is what a Catholic man is par excellence.
Yeah. Yeah. And instead, what we have is two extreme polarities of masculinity. One is the belching captain of the football team, jock, who gets with a different cheerleader every weekend.
Yes.
And the other is the – this is popular in Catholic circles. I didn't know this until I started talking about it. There are a lot of Catholic men who will affirm that being Catholic is praying the rosary, being a man, being a Catholic man, praying the rosary, going to mass, saying novenas, reading St. Augustine, reading Thomas Aquinas, being fluent in Latin, all things, by the way, that Taylor Marshall regularly preaches and says everybody should be doing. And but then they will say, but how dare you say that I should be physically active, I should be physically fit, and then they'll make up things that are dumb, like, oh, just because I don't have a beard or whatever, right? They'll kind of take some parody shots. And so the opposite is being a Catholic man is virtue. And I would respond, no, being a Catholic human is excelling in virtue. That's for women and men.
Yeah.
Women need to be prudent. Women need to be just. All the virtues. Yep. That's for humans.
Yeah.
But to be a man and to be a father, a pater, there also is the element that's physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual. And so, yes, I would argue, unless you have a handicap or you've been in an accident, you need to be able to get in the pool and throw your kids around.
Yep.
You need to be able to, you know, when your teenage son says, hey, let's race down the track and see who's faster. You need to say, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be able to lift up your wife and throw her on the couch or throw her on the bed gently. You need to be a man. You know, I think of St. Joseph. He was strong. He's a carpenter. They didn't have power drills back then.
Yeah.
And you also need to have the confidence. So I talked about the physical, but there's also the emotional intelligence of being man. And that is not being a crybaby, not complaining, not making excuses, not blaming other people, having confidence, getting things done, not asking for a cookie every time you do something good, not saying, look, honey, I emptied the dishwasher, not looking for pats on the back. This is kind of the confidence and the emotional intelligence of a well-adjusted man. But if you're addicted to porn and alcohol and stuff, your mind can't develop to be that.
For sure. And I think that's a good segue because one of the other things I found in my book that people are concerned with is the term that I use that's called effeminacy. And, you know, listen, I can't control how people define different words in the English language. I mean, let's just think of a word like, you know, the word goof. If I say you're being a goof in Canada, probably the States, it's kind of just like an insult for saying that somebody's being dumb. You know, they're being silly.
Yeah. What is a goof?
In England, and at least from talking to friends from England and friends from Ireland, it's actually in parts of the UK and the British Isles in general used to say that somebody is a sexual predator.
Oh, dang.
Anyway, so I'm just saying, like, if you called somebody a goof in the wrong area of the English speaking world, that's a problem.
That'd be bad.
So yeah, that'd be bad. So, and the same thing with the word pride. If I say to my son, I'm proud of my son, I'm not saying I'm happy that you have demonstrated the capital vice of pride as per like the original sin.
Right.
It's just, I'm humbled by your accomplishments. I'm honored that how hard you work. We know that we use words differently. Okay. Right. So as far as the word effeminacy, St. Thomas Aquinas defines it. I believe it's in Secunda, question 138. It's in the book. I define it in the book.
Okay.
And it's answer one, I believe. And, Essentially, it's a reluctance to suffer due to an attachment to pleasure. It's a reluctance to suffer due to an attachment to pleasure. There are other ways that people have used the word effeminacy, and that's fine. People can, like I said, but in my book, I talk about effeminacy as being the reluctance to suffer due to an attachment to pleasure, and that's the framework that I talk about. So I was thinking earlier, yes, there are the big ticket items, you know, addictions, you know, infidelity. Like there's all those sorts of effeminate things, because really what those are is there are things that are pleasurable, but they're unlawful and they're going to hurt you and your family. But you do them anyway because you're not willing to suffer the loss of something you want to do for your own pleasure. Do you remember Lamar Odom, the basketball player?
Mm-hmm.
So he actually, wonderful conversion story. I believe he's some sort of non-denominational Christian or something, but he was married to one of those Kardashians. He's a world champion basketball player. He's like 7 feet tall. He's like a Hulk of a man. And he kept getting these fines periodically. He was known as being like late. And they're like, why is Lamar Odom always late for the bus? Well, he also ended up falling from grace, divorced his wife, cheated on her, found his way into a brothel, like just terrible. I mean, almost overdosed. Like the guy needs some prayers. But he was wildly addicted to pornography.
Mm.
And he was late for the buses, and he was getting charged like $10,000 for being late. In the NBA, you get charged. It was, you know, he was like, he did that five or six times, and he was in his hotel room. He wanted a few more minutes of watching the X-rated videos.
Wow.
That is the epitome of effeminacy.
Yeah.
He is so – and he's changed. And I'm using him as an example, and he's come out and said that was wrong. And thanks be to God. He's such a great example for young men that are struggling with that. But he was unwilling to go through the suffering of not having the pleasure that he wanted to have,
right,
in order to do what was right.
Yeah, and he literally paid a $10,000 fine to watch a few minutes of porn.
Right. And that's,
like, that's slavery.
That's slavery. And that's the big ticket items. But even in our lives – on smaller scales, you know, I saw this guy a few months ago. I hadn't seen him in a decade or something. I knew him from growing up, and he's a lawyer now, and he's working in Toronto, and I live about 2 hours away from Toronto. So sometimes people will do is they won't commute because it's a little too far, but they'll stay in the big city for a week and come home and see their kids on the weekend or whatever. It's a common thing. I get it. And some people have different situations. I understand that. But he's a lawyer, and I know you can make a good living as a lawyer anywhere. Okay, we don't live in like an impoverished third world nation in Canada. You can be the wealthiest man in town having a small practice in a regular town. And we were talking, and the guy just seemed so unhappy. You know, he just got married, had a kid. I told him I had four kids that were 4 years old and under. He looked at me like I was a crazy person, which I kind of am. But he looks so unhappy, and he's like, well, you know, I got to work in Toronto because I'll get twice the money so we can buy twice the house. And I see my kid on the weekend, and I'll put 5 or 10 years, and I'll make a name for myself, and then I'll sell my client book or whatever, and I'll come here, and I'm thinking, you're willing to give up 5 to 10 years of being around your child to have twice the money? And once again, he wasn't impoverished. It was like, I want twice the money to have twice the house. Even that, we wouldn't look at that and say that's like the Lamar Odom example. But what we have there is a guy who is so attached to the material pleasures, to the prestige, to the name, the reputation, to I'm a lawyer at a big firm in Toronto, that he's willing to forego the formative years of raising his own children in order to materially provide for them, but not provide what is most important, which is the moral and spiritual formation. And that is an example of our reluctance to suffer due to an attachment to pleasure, which is how effeminacy is defined as per Thomas Aquinas and in my book.
Yeah. So what do we say to men? A lot of guys, I talk to a lot of young guys, talking 18 to 29, getting into 30.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys didn't have dads. Mm-hmm. A lot of them had, you know, their parents divorced young, and then he had stepdad one, and then he had stepdad two. They have no attachment or guidance or even a relationship with anyone who they would call their dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they've been, since they're, you know, teenagers are watching porn and video games and anime and just kind of a big mess. And then they have a conversion at some point.
Right.
But, you know, as Thomas Aquinas says, grace builds on nature.
Yes.
It's not like you get baptized or you get confirmed and then all of a sudden, You know, you're just this, you know, Saint Joseph upon the earth.
Yeah.
So what are some practical things that we could give to these young men who know they're lacking? They're like, look, I didn't have this. And it's not their fault.
Yeah. So in my book, in the third chapter, actually, the chapter is called Tame the Horse. Did you ever watch that movie with your kids called Spirit? It's like about a horse and a Native American guy. It's like a fun animated movie.
I know.
It's a good movie. I like it. It's about 15 years old. But anyway, in this movie, I was watching it with my sons, and there's like this First Nations Aboriginal guy who is really kind of a wild guy. And then there's this horse who is like a wild Mustang. Anyway, they're both very prideful, but they're both very capable and physically competent. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they end up having, in the theme of the movie, they have to come together and they have to become one, basically, to win the journey that they're on and stuff. But you see this struggle between the two. Like, the horse doesn't want to be ridden and the guy doesn't want to ride the horse. And they almost kind of have to both break in each other. And then they're able to do incredible things in the movie because they both have sort of given in to the needs of the other and they have a proper command. So the rider has the proper command over the horse and the horse listens, but at the same time, he's gentle to the horse and he treats him well. And anyway, so I thought that was a great analogy for the relationship that we have to have between body and soul as men. We can't just be spiritualists, right, where I pray 20 rosaries. And Matt Frad talks about this in his research on pornography. People will email him and say, you know, I've done 20 rosaries. Why am I still, you know? And he says, listen, you got to go for a run. You got to go lift some weights. I have this chapter on
jump in the cold pool, swim across the lake.
St. Francis Assisi said that.
Look, I mean, physical exercise changes the way you think. It's a fact.
Yes.
Facts. Hashtag facts. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're right. And also, our body and our, like, we're not Albigensians. We're not dualists.
Thank you.
We believe that the body was ordained to be good. And we believe that the soul is the form of the body.
Yes.
And that your body is a unique body. And your soul is a unique soul made only for your body. Okay. Which means if you're going to have cohesion in your spiritual life between body and soul, you have to tame the horse. You have to break in your body in order that it will do what is necessary and be subject to the needs of your soul so that you can achieve great heights in the spiritual life and in the moral life. So this is why we fast. Yeah. There's a reason why when Christ, I mean, there's probably, I'm sure some exorcists and stuff could say other reasons, but one of the reasons why Christ says fasting gets out certain devils is because fasting makes you weak. And the weaker you are, the more you have to depend on God.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get to the point where you are just like, I mean, you've done fasting, I've done some, and it's like 4 p.m. and you're just like, you want to pass out, fall asleep, doesn't matter how much coffee you drink. You are sitting there going, God, I got nothing left, you know, take over. And that's a great, the devil hates humility and subjugating your body and recognizing how weak you are. It forces you to be humble. And that's why and that will, in the face of pornography, in the face of alcohol addiction, in the face of video game addiction, all these things, even just being soft and not doing what you're supposed to do, you will have command over your pleasures in order to do what is right.
Absolutely. One of the people in the live chat, his name is Nate Noble, put his comment on the screen. He says, my dad left, and what helped me leave the effeminate life was exercise and doing hard things.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what you just said. We must do things that we do not want to do because effeminacy is softness.
That's what it means.
It's softness. And that is so repulsive in the eyes of women when they look at men and see that softness.
Mm-hmm.
The aversion to do hard things.
Yep. Yeah.
And so, yes, we must do devotional elements. We must go to mass. We must pray the rosary. But there's something else to this, and that is exercise, doing hard things.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And, you know, one time I was having a conversation with a guy, a very good guy, and he's not like an athlete, but he's a good man. And he said, well, what do you think? Being a man means you have to like lift heavy weights?
Yeah.
And I said, well, yes, actually, because you have to carry your cross, and the cross is very heavy. Now, that doesn't mean you – like, I don't care if you go and do powerlifting. I don't care. But you have to be physically in control. Mm-hmm. So I know a guy, he's one of the most incredible men I've ever met in my life. And he was actually one of my inspirations for the book. And he has 11 children and he's a musician. I don't think he was ever an athlete. He's definitely in shape, but the guy is like a world-class cellist, and the physical discipline it would take to be a world-class cellist, that's incredible. Even golfers, you know, I like playing golf when I can. And after about 11 holes, I'm like, I don't have the sharpness to play the way I did for the first nine on the back nine. I'm just kind of checked out. So when you watch these guys that are playing four rounds under high pressure and they're 5 hour rounds, cause it's like the professional length of the rounds, their mental acuity is extremely strong. So it's not that you have to have a big bench press, but you do have to use your body and soul, and you have to subjugate the body.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And you can do that. We see this in the lives of the saints through physical activity. Remember St. Francis of Assisi? What was he doing? God called him to rebuild the church in the context of him rebuilding a church with stones.
Right.
He was picking up stones, carrying them, and then I guess he was cementing them in somehow and reestablishing old broken down churches. This is the kind of thing that sort of wears a groove in the soul.
Yep.
You know, it's often been said young men should go, you know, work on a ship or they should go be a guide, or, you know, these are important things so that you learn to accept the frost, accept the cold.
Yeah.
Accept the heat, accept the 38 mosquito bites that you have.
38 mosquito bites.
You know, accept that you're sick and you still have a job to do, because this is what being a father ultimately is.
Yeah.
It's two kids have stubbed their toes and you have to pick up both kids
and
comfort them.
Yeah.
They were riding their scooters and they ran into each other.
Oh, goodness.
And knocked their heads. I mean, and your wife's having a bad day and she needs comfort. All of these things happen. There's a great a Catholic man, I believe he had 10 kids. He said the moment for the modern man, for the modern father, you're coming home from work, let's just say an average time is 5:34 p.m.
Yeah.
You pull into the back, you get out of the car, and you reach for the back doorknob.
Yeah.
He said, that is the moment of testing, because you worked all day. You did your job. Now you're moving into the domestic realm, which is a hard transition for a lot of men.
Yeah.
A lot of men just go to the bar and drink for an hour and then go home. But you grab the doorknob and you turn it, and your wife could be there in a dress.
Yeah.
Honey, and your favorite meal could be on the stove, and the kids could be, daddy, which happens sometimes, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
Or there could be broken glass on the ground and a kid crying and your wife in tears. You don't know.
You don't know.
But you have to put your hand on the doorknob and say, here we go, Jesus, and turn the knob and be the man, whatever it is.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's like a life's like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
Your doorknob is, yeah. So it's true. And and that is one of the hardest things as a dad. I remember, because I'm a teacher, so we have summers off, obviously. Right now, most people are off, or many people are off, but we have summers off. And I remember the first summer where we had our first son and I was home. It was actually very hard for me to transition from working, and I'm a very busy man. I coach lots of sports. I'm a very devoted man. You know, I'm one of those teachers that, you know, for that like 7 hours I'm there, it's like I'm all over the building and I'm like out of breath the whole time. And before you know it, I'm gone. But it's like I did 1,000 things, because I got to get home to my family, but I got to do my job well. You know, you got to do both. Mm-hmm. And so I'm used to, like, you know, 110 kilometers an hour the whole time. And then I come home and I've got like a 9-month-old or 11-month-old baby. My wife's pregnant with our second child, who was due in like 2 months. They were 12 months apart. And I actually, like, it was really hard for me to transition from the work life to the domestic life. And we go through a little transition of that every single day. And it's one of those moments where you're really going to show just how attached you are to your pleasures. Because when you walk in the house, you got to go to the bathroom, you know, you need a coffee, maybe you had a long day or whatever. And like, man, I walk in my house and like, there's like, I got four kids who are 4 years old and under. My wife could be literally breastfeeding the one child, and like the three kids are having a shouting match, and there's a plate on the floor, and they just, and someone just cut the other guy's forehead with his teeth because they were wrestling. And it's like, I'm not even going to get my suit jacket off for 2 hours, yeah. You know? And then eventually after supper, I'm going to go, whew, time for bedtime. And then back into it, you know? Yeah. And that's just part of being a dad.
And, but I also want to, because I don't want people to hear us complaining and all that. Mm-hmm. There are moments. And I think if you run your home properly, there are moments of the glory where you turn the doorknob and joy is there smiling and there's a great meal and the kids are finishing up some homework or homeschool. And they say, Dad, you want to go outside and play or let's go throw the ball? I mean, those moments, and it's those moments where you put in a full day and you come home and the domestic situation is working, it's going well, and you're like, man, love being married.
Yes.
Matrimony is awesome. I love having a lot of kids. So I don't want to hear, I mean, I don't want you to hear us if you're a 23-year-old man who's thinking about jumping into this. I'm going to be a Catholic dad with six kids. I don't want you to hear that it's always just broken teeth and split heads and crying wives. That's not what we're saying. We're just saying that if that happens, you can't come home and be like, oh, come on. I just been working all day. What's wrong? You know what I mean? Like you still, we're just saying that you have to be truly masculine to just step up and make everything better.
Right. You're right. 100%. I agree with you. Cool. What do you want to talk about next?
Oh, let's see. Do you want to talk about matrimony and traditional courtship?
Sure. Yeah. There's a great talk on the Fatima Center about courtship. So if anyone wants to look, just look up like Fatima Center on YouTube, courtship. There's a great talk on it. Really, the history of dating is like 50 years old. I mean, dating as we know it now. Yeah. It's pretty much with the invention of cars and young people having cars.
And contraception.
And contraception, yes, of course. And you have to think about the logistics of dating. I mean, you have to have either public transit or cars, and you have to be able to go pick your girlfriend up and, you know, whatever. There's a lot of reasons why it's a very new thing. Historically, when you would have courtship and, you know, like we said at the beginning of this, we think that our society is greatly failing women by way of men not being as virtuous as they should be. So if we critique things, it's not because we don't think that there are places for advancements and progressions in how women are treated. But what we're saying is that what we're doing isn't actually helping the problem. And one of those things that is quite bad is the way that dating takes place. Because dating has become essentially a way of being promiscuous, a way of skirting around parental authority, and a way of people having a lot of heartbreak and women being objectified by men who have no intention of marrying them. I was thinking of this guy. I used to play football in university, and this guy, he was a good guy, but I mean, we were talking in the gym one day, you know, it was just before summer breaks. It was like middle of April. And I was like, well, what are you gonna do this summer? And, I don't think I was engaged at this point, but I had my, you know, I was ready to get engaged. And he says, oh, you know, I'm going to break up with so-and-so because I'm going to go home and I want to have some fun this summer. And I thought, okay, so like you don't want to date her anymore. What's the deal here? And he said, well, no. I'll get back together with her in September. I just want to have my freedom this summer. And I felt sick to my stomach, to be honest. I thought, you weasel. Like, what are you, you know, unfortunately, though, the young lady who has grown up in this culture where that's a common thing, let this guy do that to her. And it was like, he just said it to me like, yeah, can you pass the salt? I'm thinking, you basically just said that you have a girlfriend who loves you, that looks up to you, and you're going to go home and be promiscuous with a bunch of girls you've never met, and then come back to her and say, I'm home. It's like, that's the worst. Like that is the worst. Okay. And, that is one of the things about dating. And if we didn't have dating, I mean, think of these apps like Tinder and this kind of stuff. I mean, they make my skin crawl with the way that women are treated. And proper courtship is a remedy to that. Yeah. Proper courtship is, you make your intentions known. You know, St. Alphonsus Liguori goes over this wonderfully in one of his books, but one of the books of his writings, but you make your intentions known. I am attracted to you. I want to think about being your husband. I think you are beautiful. I think you are virtuous. I think you're wonderful. Let's get to know each other in the context of being around family. My mom, when she used to go visit family in Italy, they still had the norms of like cult courtship going on. So they always wanted my mom to move back to Italy, her cousins and things. So they'd be like, we got, you know, Giovanni, he's going to take you out on a date or whatever. But they would always send her little cousin to go with them because it was the idea that, hey, you want to make sure you find an honorable man, and an honorable man is going to be able to do whatever he's going to do with you with your little cousin around. It really narrows down the activities that are going to take place. And courtship is a way of facilitating a good way of getting to know someone romantically so that you can make the right decision and maintain your virtue.
Yeah. How do we reestablish that culture of courtship? I mean, I noticed that in traditional Catholic communities, it's happening where you have priests, good Catholic priests. I see this in the fraternity of St. Peter.
Yep.
They tell these young couples, okay, you two can never be alone together.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are like, what? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
What? It's a temptation. I mean,
yeah.
I remember when I was dating, courting, whatever, Joy, I was 22.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were moving towards marriage and I was saving up for a ring and it was the real deal. And we were trying to live chaste and we were planning not to contracept when we got married, even though we were Protestants. But it's a fact that if you're a young man and you're a young woman and you're sexually attracted to this person and you're growing in love for one another and you're saying things like, I want to have your baby one day.
Yeah.
That kind of intimacy, there is great temptation. And don't you know, the devil always wants to screw up these good plans. And so I think it is prudent, you know, that you are never alone together. Doesn't mean you can't go on dates.
Yep.
But it does mean that you shouldn't be at the other person's apartment alone for 5 hours in a dark room with the TV on. That's a recipe for disaster.
Just silly. Yeah. I say in the book that, a little bit controversial, shocker for me, but, you know, all men are kind of like recovering alcoholics when it comes to lust. Some of us deal with it better than others, but we're fallen, you know. This is part of the original sin too. Eve was beautiful and so when the church fathers actually break down what the original sins are, I believe Eve commits 5 sins and I believe Adam commits 8. I think that's what I've seen in the church fathers and some sort of compilations of their writings. Of course, there's a sin of pride and things, but actually there's a sin of lust involved, because what there is there's something that's very attractive and pleasing to the eyes, which is the forbidden fruit. And it's offered to Adam by his wife. And they both forego the suffering that it would take to resist that which is sensually pleasing in order to partake in something that makes them commit a mortal sin. So there's actually a great aspect of lust in the original sin. So you have to know yourself. You have to know yourself. And also I would say we don't have to have these like 3 or 4 or 5 year dating things where we wait for a long engagement. Listen, our society does not know how to do marriage very well. Men and women have a hard time being married. They have a hard time staying married. If they are staying married, they have a hard time having a successful marriage. It's not about the sexual side of it. It's about the rightly ordered household, and it's about what you come into your marriage with, okay? If you come into your marriage and you've had 20 partners or something like that before you get married, through the power of confession, through the sacraments, all things are possible with God, and thanks be to God, there's many Catholic couples who've changed our marriage. We were not practicing Catholics when we got married. Our marriage is God-centered. It is the best thing I can ever recommend to anyone on earth. But you need to get rid of this idea that we need to be together for 4 years before we get married. Listen, you attracted to her. She's attracted to you. You're a nice guy. She's a nice girl. You have the same goals. You know each other's family.
Same beliefs. You're both Catholic.
What else you got? What else you need? You need 3 more years to make that certain. You know it. And you're just going to get to know each other while you get married. And there's no reason to have these long, tempting engagements and long courtships.
I completely agree. And then what's really sad is you have these diocesan policies where once you get engaged, they have like 18-month waiting periods.
Oh, I know.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So what can we do as fathers to make sure that our young men become men and our young women, our daughters, become virtuous ladies?
What can we do? Well, Anthony Esselin wrote a really good book. It's called Defending Boyhood or something like that. I've listened to it. I haven't read it. I've listened to an audiobook, but it's really good. And he caught a lot of flack for it. but basically we have, and I was actually talking to my dad about this yesterday. We have to look at boys and girls differently. And we have to know that some things are universal. You know, Jordan Peterson, that famous psychologist, he said, hey, we share like 80% of our qualities with each other. But that 20% accounts for like 80% of what we do, that extra. So it's kind of like that 80-20 rule, right? You know? And so there are things that are universal. Like my little kids, they both go play in the sandbox and in the mud. My daughter and my two sons, my one son's still, you know, barely crawling. And they both like playing in the sand. But when we throw my little girl outside with my boys, the boys start throwing sand at each other or building sandcastles. They get very tactile. And my daughter, she starts to act like her mom, and she comes in and she has a shovel and she has a little pail, but she says, look, mama, I'm making. And she's like trying to make bread or something. Not that that's the only thing, but you know what I mean? And then also too, just like we'll watch them playing outside, and they're, once again, they're both playing in the sand, and for 10 minutes they're kind of playing together. And then the boys kind of go off and like they've decided to go hunt for wolves in the garden or something. And then my little daughter is just walking around the backyard and she's picking up flowers and she's putting them in like a little flower pot she's made in the sandbox. And she's like, I'm making flower cake or something like that. Right. Anyway, so little boys and little girls are different. They need to see their dad being virtuous in their life, but they also need to be allowed to develop those things that are natural to them. Okay. I think it only makes sense that it's a good thing for little boys to spend a lot of time with their dad. And it's a good thing for little girls to spend a lot of time with their mom. And it's okay to have some alone time with both of those. You have to have time with both of them, like your dad with daughter and daughter with dad and boys with mom and stuff. But if we do want your sons to grow up to be virtuous, then they need to watch you being virtuous. So one of the things I've done, for example, is I've made sure I've brought my sons a lot when I'm coaching. Even though they're just little, and there's been times where I'm running around, I'm like holding a 2-year-old and I'm blowing a whistle and I'm coaching kids. But they know that when dad goes to work or dad goes to coach, he's someone who commands respect. He's someone who treats people nicely. And they say, when I grow up, I'm going to have a leadership position like dad and I'm going to treat people well. And as far as specific things, Father Ripperger has a wonderful talk on how to raise a man. And it's on YouTube. I've listened to it like 11 times. It's the best. And, you know, he talks about you do have to have sort of initiation rituals. Cultures have always had those. That might mean scouting. I mean, scouting, but you have that organization. Did you start that one, Troops of St. George?
Troops of St. George, yes. Recommend.
That's one of them. You know, where you're literally taking your boys out and you're like, hey, we're going to go out into the cold and we're going to have to learn how to fish and we're going to make a fire and all that kind of stuff. That's good too. And you have to figure out how to have initiation rituals. That'll be different depending on your place in life. Maybe you're a tradesman and it's like, you know what, you're 12 years old, son, I'm going to start taking you to work with me on Saturdays and you're not going to get paid, or I'm going to pay you $5 or whatever, and you're going to help me, you know? Yeah. And you can figure out a corollary for that for your daughters as well.
Yeah. So I'd like to maybe expand. I don't think you'll disagree with me, Kennedy. It might be a little bit different than what you articulated. So I got 8 kids and my kids are up to almost 18.
Yep.
All the way down to 4. So I got a bigger spread. My experience raising kids with Joy, you said the boys need to spend a lot more time with the dad and the girls with the mom and all that. I'm not so sure about that.
Okay.
My experience and what I would advise people is, as the children are young, and I'm talking especially under the age of reason, age 7,
right?
Their entire universe orbits around the mom.
Yeah, for sure.
If they're hungry, they don't come to me and ask me for the food, even though I still can open the pantry and hand them something. They always go to the mom. They're thirsty, they go to Joy. They're hurt, they go to Joy. I try to intervene, they don't want it. They're tired, they want someone to hold them, they go to her. It's just, and whether that's a male, they're little boys, little girls, it's just what it is.
Right.
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 And then I notice as they get above the age of reason, first communion, and they move to around 10 years old, it might be a little bit earlier, they awaken to dad. And right. suddenly things that I'm doing are of great interest to them.
Yeah.
And suddenly when they need certain things, they come to me and they don't go to Joy. And this is often hurtful for women, for mothers.
Okay.
Because they see this sort of, and it's true for boys and for girls. I don't think it's just the boys. And then I think when kids are, and people in the chat, tell me if you think I'm wrong or right on this. When kids hit adolescence, 13 and up, this is the moment where they look to dad on how am I going to live? And I think this is the reason why we see these studies where if the dad goes to church, the kids right. end up for the rest of their life going to church. But if the mom goes and the dad doesn't go, the kids drop out. Right. This is because when they get to adolescence and their bodies are full of estrogen and testosterone, and there's the temptation for rebellion and sexual immorality and drug abuse and all these things.
Right.
They're thinking, okay, yeah. mom represents inside the home. Dad represents outside the home. When I leave mm-hmm. this home, who am I going to be? And mm-hmm. I think that focuses on dad. So, for example, my daughters who are 16, they spend all kinds of time with their mom doing things. They go to the grocery store. They shop for clothes. They bake. They make dinner together, all of that. But there's also, I think, a very important element of hanging out with dad.
Right.
Debating topics, debating politics, debating religion. Why do we have to wear a chapel veil, dad? All those kind of things are more in my sphere.
Right.
And again, I don't have kids over 18. I think probably that will continue. But I think it's, like I said, I think it's more of a transition over time.
Yeah.
The males and the females. And then I've also heard from Catholic moms, because we're learning all this as we go along. A very good Catholic mom said her boys, when they hit puberty, suddenly they can't sit in mom's lap anymore or give her a hug. Because
right.
they're now right. aware of sexuality.
Right.
For the first time, they're now aware of a woman's body. And so right. there is sort of this, can I still give my mom a kiss? And okay. then around... Yeah. 15, 16, you know, they come back around and they're like, I love you, mom. And they're kissing. Like there's kind of, there's this thing that happens in them. And yeah. I think that's also part of being a healthy young man and a healthy young woman with, mm-hmm. you know, girls being able to be around their dad and realize that there's nothing sexualized about it.
Right.
It's dad. It's safe.
Right. Yeah. I 100% agree. I was just thinking more along the lines of, because you know, how to be a guy, how to be a girl, how to, you know, that stuff's so confused in our society. Just on the, I mean, even just on the psychological level, like what you're saying about the mom being the universe and then going off to dad, there's tons of literature to support that. And we're not even talking about just Catholic stuff, but just, you know, you read, I'm a teacher, so like I read in education journals and things like that. And it's a constant problem. How do we educate boys and girls? And it's funny, you know, you talk to folks who are, this is just from my experience at conferences and things. And you talk to folks who really are progressive politically. They're very much leftists. But then when we talk about like our students or what they've seen in their career, you know, I've sat through presentations, listening to this stuff, and it's a real debate. Like, should we have boy-centric, girl-centric education for the boys? Does it matter if the teacher's a guy or a girl? Does it matter if they're separated at a certain age? You know, you talk to grade 7 and 8 teachers and ask them what it's like to deal with a bunch of gangly, you know, prepubescent, early pubescent 12 and 13 year old boys in a group with a bunch of girls who are more mature than they are. And it's like, it's not an easy thing for classroom management. And, so there's this constant tension between how we treat boys and how we treat girls. So I 100% agree with you. I was just more thinking of, you know, for our boys to see what it means to be a man, they spend time with their dad, and girls vice versa. But definitely that psychological projection, I think Piaget, he talked about the Piagetian model of that. I think he talked about that as well. He was an educational philosopher. But anyway, yeah, sounds good.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so tell us, we have just 3 minutes left here. Yeah. Tell us – okay. Little bit kind of maybe an outline of the book.
All right.
And what, you know, I think people should get the book and tell them when they get the book, what are they going to see? Is this a self-help book? Is this an anti-feminism book? Is this a masculinity book? What is it?
It is. Well, it's not an anti-feminism book per se. Okay. People need to relax about that. There's 10 chapters. We go through the reality of the devil. We go through what it means to be effeminate, what it means to tame your body. We talk about how to protect your home from the non-Christian, Gnostic, pagan, New Age stuff that's in our culture, which is huge in homes.
So important.
So important. We talk about, I call it the devil's playground, which is pornography. We also talk about media. You know, people think, hey, I give my kid an iPad and it's got parental controls. It's like, yeah, the medium is the message. You've just taught your kid that being alone and staring at a screen is how he should spend his time as a six-year-old. You got to be careful with that, you know. We talk about building a domestic church. You're the priest of your household. What does that mean, right? That's not easy to do. You got to have a rule of life. You got to act like a priest. We talk, one chapter is called Camel Knees, because St. James used to spend so much time on his knees that they said he had the knees of a camel. I've seen men with like tiny calluses on their knees from spending hours in prayer. I can't imagine what it means to have knobbly camel knees from being on your, so that I heard that from Jesse Romero, actually. So the one chapter is called Lead On, Brave Heart, I Will Follow. I use the Crusades as a model where holy men of God have to respond to God's call to us to fight for what we believe in, to fight for what is necessary for the health of the church, and to protect our wives and our children. And that's what the crusade mentality is. It's not about the crusades per se, but there's a model in there. Okay. And then the final chapter, I talk about the Blessed Mother. The Blessed Mother saved my soul. She brought me back to the church. I owe her every ounce of my life. I talk about my conversion story in there. And if you want to be a good Catholic man, you got to be a mama's boy. And you gotta call your Blessed Mother. You gotta put down the iPhone and you gotta pick up the rosary. You gotta put down your video game controller and you gotta pick up your rosary, your chaplain Saint Joseph. You gotta get rid of your stupid, you know, satanic images of lust and temptation you're flooding yourself with, and you gotta start looking at the Blessed Mother. You gotta contemplate purity and beauty and perfect, you know, supernatural femininity and the wonderful thing that our Blessed Mother gives us. And you've got to become a man. And by becoming a mama's boy under the Blessed Mother, you know, you'll learn how to stomp serpents alongside of her. And it's a wonderful thing. And then I end the book with an epilogue. And it is the articles about St. Joseph that I wrote. And it's a way of growing in devotion to St. Joseph.
Good. Solid. Yeah. Excellent. Cool. And it came out on the Feast of Joseph the Worker last Friday.
Yes, it did. Yes, it
appropriate.
Did.
Appropriate. Yeah. So the link to this book, you can get it on Amazon. People always say, Marshall, why are you always linking to Amazon? Well, it's hard to link to other Christian Catholic bookstores. I'm just saying that. And everybody knows Amazon. So look, I know Amazon ain't the best, but it's what we got. It's easy to do. And for books, there it is. So Terror of Demons, Reclaiming Traditional Catholic Masculinity by Kennedy Hall. The link to it is in the live chat. It's also beneath this video. Check it out. Mm-hmm. And any parting words before we pray our Latin Ave Maria, especially I think, Kennedy, if you could give a shout out or a parting word to Catholic young men. A lot of them are watching right now. I can see them in the live stream. So a parting word, maybe a challenge.
Well, Mother's Day is coming up, okay? So the best gift you can give your mother, whether she's your mother or the mother of your children, the best gift you can give her is being a man of God, okay? Don't give her this book for Mother's Day, but get the book for yourself and become a man that's worthy of being called son, worthy of being called husband, and worthy of being called father, okay? This book will help you. I believe it is a manual. Is it a do-it-yourself manual that you can use to go from, hey, if you're already on the narrow path, you'll supercharge your steps on the stairway to heaven. That's great. If you're not on the narrow path, you can get yourself out of the clutches of Satan, and you can start stomping hell for a living. And I think that this book will help you do that.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, Oremus, let us pray our Ave Maria. You do the second half, Kennedy?
Sure.
I will do Ave Maria and Gloria Patri. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus.
Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostre. Amen.
Gloria Patri, et Filio, et Spiritui Sancto.
Sicut erat in principio, et nunc et semper, et in saecula saeculorum. Amen.
Sancte Joseph.
Ora pro nobis.
Nomine Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. Amen. And y'all already know what I'm going to say. And that is, as he just said, pick up those beads, get the weapon, pray the rosary every day. If you don't pray the rosary, you're not on the team. And if you're like, how do I be a Catholic man? What do I do? What book do I read? What? If you're not praying the rosary every day, you just
doesn't matter.
You fail. And if you want to defeat pornography, praying the rosary every day, I know so many men who have said that was a key element. It's not the only element.
Mm-hmm.
Not the only element. It's not a single bullet kill shot. But you got to begin by praying the rosary every day. You want to think about the most pure and immaculate woman.
Yes.
That ever has or ever will exist. You see her right there on the screen, the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Exactly.
So that's where you got to begin. Pray the rosary. And of course, all you ladies out there, pray the rosary every single day. That is our chain. It's our anchor into heaven's gates. So pray the rosary. Everybody, God bless you. Get the book, Terror of Demons, Reclaiming Traditional Catholic Masculinity by Kennedy Hall. And we'll see you again tomorrow, Friday, at the normal time, 9 a.m. Central. I'm deciding whether I want to talk about Bill Gates, these chips, these vaccine chips. It's bogus, man. Is that Mark of the Beast or what?
I don't know.
Or I also got 10 ways practicing Catholicism will change after Corona. Both big topics. Maybe I'll do one Friday, one Monday. So make sure you're subscribed. Make sure you like this video. Make sure you share this video right now underneath Kennedy Hall. Hit the share button. Share it on Facebook, Twitter, whatever you do, social media. Till next time, God bless, Godspeed. Kennedy Hall, thank you.
Thank you, sir.